This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Recovering, Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Written and read by Leslie Jameson.
For anyone addiction has touched. 1. Wonder. The first time I ever felt it, the buzz, I was almost 13. I didn't vomit or black out or even embarrass myself. I just loved it. I loved the crackle of champagne, its hot pine needles down my throat. We were celebrating my brother's college graduation, and I wore a long muslin dress that made me feel like a child, until I felt something else. Initiated. A glow. The whole world stood accused. You never told me it felt this good. The first time I ever drank in secret, I was 15. My mom was out of town. My friends and I spread a blanket across living room hardwood and drank whatever we could find in the fridge, Chardonnay wedged between the orange juice and the mayonnaise. We were giddy from a sense of trespass. The first time I ever got high, I was smoking pot on a stranger's couch, my fingers dripping pool water as I dampened the joint with my grip. A friend of a friend had invited me to a swimming party. My hair smelled like chlorine and my body quivered against my damp bikini. Strange little animals blossomed through my elbows and shoulders where the parts of me bent and connected. I thought, what is this? And how can it keep being this? With a good feeling, it was always more, again, forever. The first time I ever drank with a boy, I let him put his hands under my shirt on the wooden balcony of a lifeguard station. Dark waves shushed the sand below our dangling feet. My first boyfriend. He liked to get high. He liked to get his cat high. We used to make out in his mother's minivan. He came to a family meal at my house fully wired on speed. "So talkative," said my grandma, deeply smitten. At Disneyland, he broke open a baggie of withered mushroom caps and started breathing fast and shallow in line for Big Thunder Mountain Railroad, sweating through his shirt, pawing at the orange rocks of the fake frontier. If I had to say where my drinking began, which first time began it, I might say it started with my first blackout, or maybe the first time I sought blackout. The first time I wanted nothing more than to be absent from my own life. Maybe it started the first time I threw up from drinking, the first time I dreamed about drinking, the first time I lied about drinking, the first time I dreamed about lying about drinking, when the craving had gotten so deep there wasn't much of me that wasn't committed to either serving or fighting it. Maybe my drinking began with patterns rather than moments, once I started drinking every day. Which happened in Iowa City, where the drinking didn't seem dramatic and pronounced so much as encompassing and inevitable. There were so many ways and places to get drunk. The fiction bar in a smoky double-wide trailer with a stuffed fox head and a bunch of broken clocks. Or the poetry bar down the street, with its anemic cheeseburgers and glowing Schlitz ad, a scrolling electric landscape. The gurgling stream, the neon grassy banks, the flickering waterfall. I mashed the lime in my vodka tonic and glimpsed, in the sweet spot between two drinks and three, then three and four, then four and five, my life as something illuminated from the inside. There were parties at a place called the Farmhouse, out in the cornfields, past Friday fish fries at the American Legion. These were parties where poets wrestled in a kiddie pool full of jello, and everyone's profile looked beautiful in the crackling light of a mattress bonfire. Winters were cold enough to kill you. There were endless potlucks where older writers brought braised meats and younger writers brought plastic tubs of hummus, and everyone brought whiskey, and everyone brought wine. Winter kept going. We kept drinking. Then it was spring. We kept drinking then, too. Sitting on a folding chair in a church basement, you always face the question of how to begin. It has always been a hazard for me to speak at an AA meeting, a man named Charlie told a Cleveland AA meeting in 1959, because I knew that I could do better than other people. I really had a story to tell. I was more articulate. I could dramatize it, and I would really knock them dead. He explained the hazard like this. He'd gotten praised. He'd gotten proud. He'd gotten drunk. Now he was talking to a big crowd about how dangerous it was for him to talk to a big crowd. He was describing the perils of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was being articulate about being articulate. He was dramatizing what the art of dramatizing had done to him. He said, "I think I got tired of being my own hero." 15 years earlier, he'd published a best-selling novel about alcoholism while sober, but he relapsed a few years after it became a bestseller. "I've written a book that's been called the definitive portrait of the alcoholic," he told the group, "and it did me no good." It was only after 5 minutes of talking that Charlie finally thought to begin the way others began. "My name is Charles Jackson," he said, "and I'm an alcoholic." By coming back to the common refrain, he was reminding himself that commonality could be its own saving grace. "My story isn't much different from anyone's," he said. "It's the story of a man who was made a fool of by alcohol over and over and over, year after year after year, until finally the day came when I learned that I could not handle this alone." The first time I ever told the story of my drinking, I sat among other drinkers who no longer drank. Ours was a familiar scene, plastic folding chairs, styrofoam cups of coffee gone lukewarm, phone numbers exchanged. Before the meeting, I had imagined what might happen after it was done. People would compliment my story or the way I'd told it, and I'd demur, "Well, I'm a writer," shrugging, trying not to make too big a deal of it. I'd have the Charlie Jackson problem, my humility imperiled by my storytelling prowess. I practiced with note cards beforehand, though I didn't use them when I spoke, because I didn't want to make it seem like I'd been practicing. It was after I'd gone through the part about my abortion and how much I'd been drinking pregnant, after the part about the night I don't call date rape and the etiquette of reconstructing blackouts, after I'd gone through the talking points of my pain, which seemed like nothing compared to what the other people in that room had lived. It was somewhere in the muddled territory of sobriety, getting to the repetitions of apology or the physical mechanics of prayer, that an old man in a wheelchair, sitting in the front row, started shouting, "This is boring." We all knew him, this old man. He'd been instrumental in setting up a gay recovery community in our town back in the 70s, and now he was in the care of his much younger partner, a soft-spoken book lover who changed the man's diapers and wheeled him faithfully to meetings where he shouted obscenities. "You dumb cunt," he'd called out once. Another time, he'd held my hand for our closing prayer and said, "Kiss me, wench." He was ill, losing the parts of his mind that filtered and restrained his speech. But he often sounded like our collective id, saying all the things that never got said aloud in meetings. "I don't care. This is tedious. I've heard this before." He was nasty and sour, and he also saved a lot of people's lives. Now, he was bored. Other people at the meeting shifted uncomfortably in their seats. The woman sitting beside me touched my arm, a way of saying, "Don't stop." So I didn't. I kept going, stuttering, eyes hot, throat swollen. But this man had managed to tap veins of primal insecurity, that my story wasn't good enough or that I'd failed to tell it right, that I'd somehow failed at my dysfunction, failed to make it bad or bold or interesting enough, that recovery had flatlined my story past narrative repair. When I decided to write a book about recovery, I worried about all of these possible failures. I was wary of trotting out the tired tropes of the addictive spiral,
and wary of the tedious architecture and tawdry self-congratulation of a redemption story. It hurt. It got worse. I got better. Who would care? This is boring. When I told people I was writing a book about addiction and recovery, I often saw their eyes glaze. Oh, that book, they seemed to say. I've already read that book. I wanted to tell them that I was writing a book about that glazed look in their eyes, about the way an addiction story can make you think, I've heard that story before you've even heard it. I wanted to tell them I was trying to write a book about the ways addiction is a hard story to tell, because addiction is always a story that has already been told, because it inevitably repeats itself, because it grinds down, ultimately, for everyone, to the same demolished and reductive and recycled core. Desire. Use. Repeat. In recovery, I found a community that resisted what I'd always been told about stories, that they had to be unique, suggesting instead that a story was most useful when it wasn't unique at all, when it understood itself as something that had been lived before and would be lived again. Our stories were valuable because of this redundancy, not despite it. Originality wasn't the ideal, and beauty wasn't the point. When I decided to write a book about recovery, I didn't want to make it singular. Nothing about recovery had been singular. I needed the first-person plural, because recovery had been about immersion in the lives of others. Finding the first-person plural meant spending time in archives and interviews so I could write a book that might work like a meeting, that would place my story alongside the stories of others. I could not handle this alone. That had already been said. I wanted to say it again. I wanted to write a book that was honest about the grit and bliss and tedium of learning to live in this way, in chorus, without the numbing privacy of getting drunk. I wanted to find an articulation of freedom that didn't need scare quotes or lacquer, that didn't insist on distinction as the only mark of a story worth telling, that wondered why we took that truth to be self-evident, or why I'd always taken it that way. If addiction stories run on the fuel of darkness, the hypnotic spiral of an ongoing, deepening crisis, then recovery is often seen as the narrative slack, the dull terrain of wellness, a tedious addendum to the riveting blaze. I wasn't immune. I'd always been enthralled by stories of wreckage. But I wanted to know if stories about getting better could ever be as compelling as stories about falling apart. I needed to believe they could. I moved to Iowa City just after my 21st birthday, in a little black Toyota with a television riding shotgun and a winter coat that wasn't even thick enough to keep me warm through autumn. I lived in a white clapboard house on Dodge Street, just below Burlington, and hit the circuit right away. Backyard parties under branches strung with tiny white Christmas lights, mason jars full of red wine, local bratwurst on the grill. The grass shimmered with mosquitoes, and fireflies blinked on and off like the eyes of some coy, elusive god. Maybe that sounds ridiculous. It was magic. Writers 10 years older than I was, 20 years older, 30 years older, talked about their drumming careers and prior bylines, their prior marriages, while I found myself without much life to talk about. I'd come to live. I was going to do things at parties here that I might talk about at parties later, elsewhere. I was drumming with that promise and nervous. I drank quietly, quickly, staining my teeth with Shiraz. I'd come to get my master's degree at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, an institution barnacled with history. It seemed to me the program was always asking you to prove why you deserve to be there, and I wasn't sure I did. I'd been rejected from every other program I'd applied to. One night, I showed up at a potluck, brick building, basement unit, carpeted floors, and found everyone sitting in a circle. It was a game. You had to tell your best story, your absolute best. I can't remember anyone else's. I'm not sure I even listened to anyone else. I was so afraid no one would like what I said. When it was finally my turn, I pulled out the only story of mine that reliably made people laugh. It was about the community service trip I'd taken to a Costa Rican village when I was 15. I'd run into a wild horse on a dirt road on my walk home one day, and then later confused the words for caballo and caballero while I was trying to tell my host family about the encounter. When I saw the concern on their faces, I tried to reassure them that I actually loved horses and ended up telling them how much I enjoyed riding gentlemen. At this point, in the carpeted basement, I got onto my feet and mimed riding a horse as I'd mimed it for my host family years earlier. People laughed a little bit. In my horse riding position, I felt like an overzealous charades player. I quietly arranged myself cross-legged again. The structure of that basement game was nearly identical to the structure of the program itself. Every Tuesday afternoon, we gathered in workshops to critique each other's stories. These discussions happened in an old wooden building by the river, beige with dark green trim. When we clustered on the porch before class, under the red-leafed October trees, I smoked cloves and listened to their sweet crackle. Someone had once told me cloves had little bits of glass in them, and I always pictured shards glittering through the smoky chambers of my lungs. Whenever it was your week to get critiqued, copies of your story were stacked on a wooden shelf, always more than enough copies for everyone in your class. If other people in the program were interested in your work, all the copies of your story would disappear. You'd sell out, or else you wouldn't. Either way, you'd sit at a round table for an hour and listen to 12 other people dissect the virtues and failures of what you'd written. Then you were expected to go out afterward with those same people and drink. If most days in Iowa were like a test, some version of that first night swapping stories in a basement, then sometimes I passed and sometimes I failed. Sometimes I got high and worried about sounding stupid, even though the whole point of getting high was that you weren't supposed to worry if you sounded stupid. Sometimes I went home at the end of the night and cut myself. Cutting was a habit I'd picked up in high school. It was something my first boyfriend had done, the same one who took enough mushrooms at Disneyland to get scared of the frontier. He'd had his reasons, traumas in his past. At first, I told myself I was doing it because I wanted to get closer to him. But eventually I had to admit I was drawn to cutting for reasons of my own. It let me carve onto my skin a sense of inadequacy I'd never managed to find words for, a sense of hurt whose vagueness, shadowed always by the belief it was unjustified, granted appeal to the concrete clarity of a blade drawing blood. It was a pain I could claim because it was physical and irrefutable, even if I was always ashamed of it for being voluntary. I'd been shy for most of my childhood, afraid to speak because I was afraid of saying the wrong thing, afraid of popular felicity, a girl in eighth grade who'd cornered me by the lockers to ask why I didn't shave my legs, afraid of the girls in the locker room who laughed in a huddle and finally asked me why I never wore deodorant, afraid even of the kinder girls on my cross-country team, the ones who asked why I never spoke. Afraid of dinners with my father, which happened maybe once a month, when I wasn't sure what to say, and often ended up saying something sullen or bratty, something that might compel his attention. Cutting was a way to do something. When my high school boyfriend told me he thought we should break up, I felt so powerless, so spurned, that I threw a stack of plastic cups against my bedroom wall so hard they shattered into shards. I drew these shards across my left ankle until it was a messy ladder of red hatch marks. It makes me cringe, looking back at my own theatrical production of angst, but I also feel a certain tenderness toward that girl, who wanted to pronounce the size of how she felt and used what she could. Disposable plastic picnic cups, the mode of harm she'd borrowed from the one who was leaving her. It had been a kind of camaraderie between me and him, wearing long sleeves during Southern California summers so our parents couldn't see the cuts on our arms, explaining the band-aids on my ankles as shaving nicks. Cutting and writing were the ways I'd found around my chronic shyness, which felt like constant failure. At Iowa, my short stories were the kind that got called character-driven because they never had plots. But I was suspicious of my characters. They were always passive. They suffered from diseases. They suffered assaults. Their dogs got heartworms. They were either fake or else they were me. They were cruel and cruelly treated. I sent them into suffering because I was sure that suffering was gravity, and gravity was all I wanted. My work followed pain like a heat-seeking missile. Even as a young girl, my princess characters had died by dragon breath more often than they'd gotten married. In 10th grade, I'd been assigned to write a response to another student's painting, an abstract swirl of red and purple, and I wrote a story about a girl in a wheelchair dying in a house fire. That first year at Iowa, I lived with a journalist in her 30s who had spent years writing newspaper articles about the New York City art scene. She knew how to roast a chicken stuffed with whole lemons, hot and pulpy and sour. The fact of cooked lemons seemed undeniably adult to me, a sign of having crossed some sort of threshold. On Wednesday nights, we drove out to the farmer's auction in a big barn just west of town. Tractors and livestock and estate sales, old LPs and old swords and old Coke cans, trash and treasure, where you could buy funnel cakes and watch the auctioneers ride their giant high chairs through the aisles, speaking their incomprehensible staccato language. Now 4.50, can I get a 5 now? 5 from the back. Back home, we sweated in our kitchen, melting goat cheese and torn up basil into couscous and then spooning it into the little purses of fried squash blossoms. The smell of oil-blistered vegetable skin was everywhere. Those days were like that, humid, insistent. I had this thought that sautéing things would make me an adult. Some nights when I got restless and had trouble sleeping, I would drive out to the biggest truck stop in the world, 40 miles east on I-80. It had a 50-foot buffet and showers for the truckers. It even had a dentist and a chapel. I scribbled character-driven dialogue in my notebooks and drank mugs of black coffee filmed with broken lily pads of grease. At 3 in the morning, I ordered apple dumplings and vanilla ice cream and cleaned the bowl with my tongue. Miles of darkened cornfields all around me. It seemed like everyone drank in Iowa City. Even if no one drank all the time, there was always someone drinking at any particular time. When I wasn't pretending to ride a cowboy, trying to earn my seat on the shag, I spent my nights balancing on leather stools at the writer's bars on Market Street, George's and the Foxhead. Writer's bar was a non-exclusive term. Really, any bar where writers drank could be a writer's bar. The Deadwood, the Dublin Underground, the Mill, the Hilltop, the Vine, Mickey's, the Airliner, that place with a patio on the Ped Mall, that other place with a patio on the Ped Mall, that place with a patio just a block from the Ped Mall. But the Foxhead was the most writerly bar of all, and also the smokiest. The ventilation system was just a hole someone had shoved a fan into. The girls' bathroom was covered with marker scrawl about men in the workshop. So-and-so would fuck anyone. So-and-so would fuck you over. Some of the guys called me barely legal because I was so young. And I wondered if that phrase lived above a urinal in the guys' room. I hoped. It seemed like living to be someone who inspired gossip in black marker. Even as Iowa got colder, I always wore my cheapest jacket to the Foxhead because I didn't want to get my other jacket smoky. My cheapest jacket was thin, knee-length black velour with a faux fur trim so large I felt comfortably recessed within it, shivering, arms crossed tight across my chest. Years later, I read about an undergrad in Ames who had gotten drunk and died in the snow. His body found at the bottom of the stairs in some old agricultural warehouse. But back then, I wasn't thinking about dying in the snow. I drank until I couldn't feel the cold. After the bars closed, I kept drinking in the chilly apartments of boys who were trying to save money on their heating bills. One night, I ended up in the chilly apartment of a boy I liked, or who I thought might like me. The two possibilities were nearly indistinguishable, or else the first barely mattered. There were a few of us at his place, and someone brought out a baggie of Coke. It was my first time ever seeing Coke, and it was like stepping into a movie. During high school, it seemed like all the other girls had been doing Coke since they were toddlers. Popular Felicity with her smooth-shaven legs, I was sure she'd done it all the time. While I'd been drinking Diet Cokes at PG-13 movies, spending weeks choosing an ankle-length, blue-lace, semi-formal dress. Truth be told, I wasn't sure exactly how to do Coke. I knew you snorted it, but I didn't know what that looked like. I tried to summon every movie I'd ever seen. How close did you get? How close had that girl gotten in Cruel Intentions, snorting from a secret stash in her silver crucifix? I didn't want to tell this guy it was my first time doing Coke. I wanted to have done Coke so many times, I couldn't even count how many times I'd done Coke. Instead, I was someone who needed to be reminded, gently, to use the cut straw. "I feel like I'm corrupting you," this guy said. He was 24 but acted like those 3 years were a canyon between us. They were. I wanted to say, "Corrupt me." I was wearing bright white pants with a big silver buckle attached, kneeling in front of this guy's coffee table, doing a line straightened by a credit card that was honestly probably a debit card, sniffing loudly. There was nothing feigned about how much I loved that icy swell, that sense of so much to say. We had all night. The woman who'd brought the Coke was gone. Everyone was gone. We could talk till dawn. I imagined him saying, "I've always wondered what you were thinking." Other people were always the ones who got noticed, the Felicities of the world. But now, this guy was putting on a record, blood on the tracks, and Dylan's scratchy voice filled the cold room, and the Coke charged my pitter-pattering heart, and it was finally my turn. The icy swell believed in me, and it believed in what this night could become. I'd only ever kissed 3 guys. With every one of them, I'd imagined an entire future unfolding between us. Now, I was imagining it with this one. I hadn't told him about it yet, but maybe I would. Maybe I'd tell him while dawn broke over the park beyond his bay windows. "Who actually wears white pants?" he asked me. "You see them, but you don't think of anyone actually wearing them." I kept sitting on his couch for hours and hours, waiting for him to kiss me. I finally asked him, "Are you going to kiss me?" Meaning, are you going to try to sleep with me? Because there was enough Coke and vodka inside me to ask out loud, to peel away whatever feeble skin remained between the world and my need to be affirmed by it. The answer was no. He wasn't going to try to sleep with me. The closest he got to trying to sleep with me was saying, just before I left, "Hey, not everybody can pull off white pants," as a kind of consolation prize. As I was leaving, he kissed me in his doorway. "Is that what you wanted?" he said, and a sob rose in my throat, salty and swollen. I was drunk, but not drunk enough. It was the worst humiliation, to be seen like this, not desired, but desiring. I couldn't let myself cry in front of him. So I did it on the way home, walking through the cold, at 4 in the morning, my white pants gleaming like stretched headlights in the dark. When I got home that night, I stumbled upstairs, tripped, and fell face first onto the steps, hard enough that the next day a huge bruise ripened on my shin. That night, freshly spurned, I wanted to see what he'd seen when he turned me away. In the mirror, I was someone red-eyed, someone who had been crying, or maybe had allergies. She had some white dust under her nose. She took it on her fingertip and rubbed it on her gums. She'd seen them do that in the movies, too. She was sure of it. We weren't the first people who'd gotten drunk in Iowa. We knew that. The myths of Iowa City drinking ran like subterranean rivers beneath the drinking we were doing. They surged with dreamlike tales of dysfunction. Raymond Carver and John Cheever tire squealing through early morning grocery store parking lots to restock their liquor stash. John Berryman opening bar tabs on Dubuque Street and ranting about Whitman till dawn, playing chess and leaving his bishops vulnerable. Dennis Johnson getting drunk at the Vine and writing short stories about getting drunk at the Vine. We got drunk at the Vine too, though it was in a different building now, on a different block. We knew this too, how imprecisely we squatted in the old tales, how we only got them in glimpses and imperfect replicas. I often thought about Iowa with that we. We drank here. We drank there. We drank somehow with those who would drink after us, just as we drank with those who had come before. One of Johnson's poems described being just a poor mortal human who had stumbled onto the glen where the failed gods are drinking. When Cheever showed up to teach in Iowa, he was grateful for the glen. It was a place where he could drink without his family asking why he was killing himself. Back home, he'd been hiding bottles under car seats and lacing his iced tea with gin. But in Iowa, there was no need to pretend. Carver drove him to the liquor store first thing in the morning. It opened at 9, so they left at 8:45, and Cheever would be opening the car door before the car was fully stopped. Of their friendship, Carver said, he and I did nothing but drink. These were the legends I inherited. The air was thick with them. Richard Yates spent his hungover mornings at a booth in the airliner, eating hard-boiled eggs and listening to Barbara Streisand on the jukebox. One of his students, Andre Debuse, offered to lend him his wife during a rough patch. Yates took Debuse drinking after his first novel didn't sell, and I took my best friend drinking when her first novel didn't sell. At the Deadwood, during the part of the afternoon called Angry Hour, which came just before happy hour and had even steeper discounts. I tried and failed to think of what to say, and wondered if I'd ever finish a novel, and how much it would sell for. In John Barleycorn, a novel published in 1913, Jack London conjured two kinds of drunks, the ones who stumbled through the gutters hallucinating blue mice and pink elephants, and the ones to whom the white light of alcohol had granted access to bleak truths, the pitiless, spectral syllogisms of the white logic. The first type of drunk had his mind ravaged by booze, bitten numbly by numb maggots. But the second type had his mind sharpened instead. He could see more clearly than ordinary men. He sees through all illusions. God is bad, truth is a cheat, and life is a joke. Wife, children, friends, in the clear white light of his logic, they are exposed as frauds and shams. He sees their frailty, their meagerness, their sordidness, their pitifulness. The imaginative drunk bore this vision as gift and curse at once. Booze granted sight and charged for it, with a sudden spill or a gradual oozing away. London called the sadness of drinking a cosmic sadness, not a small sorrow, but a grand one. In the old British folk song in which he'd first appeared, John Barleycorn was the personification of grain alcohol itself, a spirit attacked by drunkards laid low by booze, men seeking revenge for what he had done to them. In London's novel, he was more like a sadistic fairy godmother, granting the harsh gift of bleak wisdom. He'd certainly visited the writer legends of Iowa, the ones who cast their long, staggering shadows over our carved-up bar booths. Carver's shadow was the drunkest of them all. His stories were painful and precise, like carefully bitten fingernails, full of silence and whiskey, just one more rounds and next one's on me rounds. His characters cheated and got cheated on. They got each other drunk and dragged each other's passed out bodies onto porches. People got roughed up, no big shucks. A vitamin saleswoman got drunk and broke her finger, then woke up with a hangover so bad it was like somebody was sticking wires in her brain. The stories I'd heard about Carver's life suggested a rogue running on booze and fumes, leaving meals unfinished because he was getting all his sugar from liquor, walking out of restaurants before he paid the bills, moving the class he taught from the English department to the back room of the mill, one of his favorite bars. "You can't tell a bunch of writers not to smoke," he insisted, as his department had tried to do. One time, he ended up with a stranger he'd let crash in his hotel room after a hard night of drinking. The young man stripped to leopard print briefs and pulled out a jar of Vaseline. Another time, Carver showed up uninvited at the home of a colleague, holding a bottle of Wild Turkey, and said, "Now we are going to tell each other our life stories." I pictured Carver in terms of hijinks and love triangles, petty theft and seductions, ash falling unnoticed from the tip of his cigarette as he sat engrossed at his typewriter, riding the comet's tail of a bender into its ruthless wisdom. Whatever psychic ledges his long drunks had taken him to, whatever voids he had glimpsed from those perches, I pictured him deftly smuggling that desperation into the quiet betrayals and pregnant pauses of his fiction. One of Carver's friends put it like this: "Ray was our designated Dylan Thomas, I think. Our contact with the courage to face all possible darkness and survive." That was my default sense of all possible darkness back then. Carver, Thomas, London, Cheever, these white scribes and their epic troubles. When I thought of addiction, I certainly wasn't thinking about Billie Holiday incarcerated for a year in West Virginia or handcuffed to her deathbed at a midtown Manhattan hospital. I wasn't thinking of the elderly white drunks gathering every morning at the non-writers' bars at the edges of our cornfields, veterans and farmers, the ones for whom intoxication wasn't mythic fuel but daily, numbing relief, the ones who didn't narrate their drunken binges as brushes against existential wisdom. Back then, I was too busy imagining Carver falling asleep past dawn with polka dot burns on his hands and a stack of heartbroken pages in his lap, a diplomat from the bleakest reaches of his own wrecked life. I kept expecting to see notes for one of his stories carved into a wooden booth at the Foxhead. I could only imagine the bathroom marker gossip he'd inspired. "It was really difficult even to look at him," one acquaintance said. "The booze and the cigarettes were so much there that they seemed like another person with us in the room." During the worst of his drinking, Carver claimed he was spending $1,200 a month on liquor, a handsome monthly salary he paid the other person in the room. "Of course there's a mythology that goes along with the drinking," Carver once said. "But I was never into that. I was into the drinking itself." "I was into the drinking too, but I was also into the mythology of the guy who wasn't into its myth. I was pretty sure we all were." Carver loved London's John Barleycorn. He recommended it to an editor over noon drinks, told him emphatically that it dealt with invisible forces, then left the table and walked out of the restaurant. Early the next morning, that same editor got a call from county jail, where Carver was sleeping on a cement floor behind bars. Daniel was a poet who lived above a falafel shop and drove a garbage truck. I met him at the Deadwood, a downtown bar full of pinball machines. We were drunk, of course, blinking against the sudden lights of closing time. Daniel had dark hair and blue eyes, and when someone said he looked like Morrissey, I had to look up who Morrissey was. I let him take me home and lay me down across his lumpy futon mattress. We ate chocolate ice cream from the carton under his scratchy wool blanket and watched porn. I'd never seen porn. I wanted to know if the delivery guy was going to fall in love with the nurse. "There's not really a plot," he said. But he was a plot. Daniel had a history of misadventures that I always wanted to hear more about, as if I were a pickpocket rummaging for anecdotes. That time he dressed up as a pirate and woken up in his apartment stairwell covered in vomit. That time his ex had contacted spirits using a Ouija board on a picnic bench outside a donut shop in Wyoming. Life with Daniel was weird and ragged and unexpected. It tingled. He was a messy eater. There were bits of cabbage in his beard, patches of ice cream melted on his sheets, crusted pots and pans in his sink, tiny beard hairs all over his bathroom counter. He left scraps of possible poetry scribbled on the covers of old New Yorkers piled around my bedroom. Reality is survival, equipped with drawers of underwear, a few bathroom candles, and maybe a scepter hidden up somewhere in the attic. When we went to a party where everyone was drinking single malt scotch and writing tasting notes, other people wrote mossy, smoky, earthy, while Daniel wrote tastes like the dust thrown up by the wheels of a chariot in ancient Rome. When we did coke together, it wasn't the first time I was doing it. We had sex one night in a graveyard at the edge of town. We drove to New Orleans because we had a car. I canceled the classes I was supposed to teach or got friends to cover so we could watch the History Channel under mustard yellow scratchy motel blankets in the middle of wherever, Mississippi. We got shots of well whiskey in the early afternoon and ran through the back alleys of the French Quarter. Daniel and his friends, a crew of older poets, spent evenings shooting air rifles at empty PBR cans. I watched his profile flicker in the glow of bonfires. I was self-conscious about being so young, only 21. So I lied and told Daniel I was 22. That math felt right at the time. Daniel's friends intimidated me. He told me his friend Jack had slept with 125 women. I wondered if Jack wanted to sleep with me. One night, I told Jack that I sometimes drove out to the truck stop in the middle of the night and worked in the vinyl booths by the supply shop, overlooking all those chrome hubcaps in the aisles. "You just got 100 times more interesting," he said. And I tried to divide myself by 100, right there in front of him, to figure out what I'd been before. If there was one book that everyone worshipped at Iowa, poet oracles and prose architects alike, it was Dennis Johnson's Jesus's Son. This collection of stories was our Bible of beauty and damage, a hallucinated vision of how and where we lived, full of farmhouse parties and hungover mornings, blue skies bright enough to make your eyeballs ache. Half the book took place in Iowa City bars. Crazy things happened at the corner of Burlington and Gilbert, where we now had a come-and-go gas station. The story, Emergency, took its title from the big sign on Mercy Hospital, glowing red letters against brick that I associated with walking home drunk on winter nights, numb to the chill. In the world of Johnson's stories, you leaned close to sip your liquor like a hummingbird over a blossom. There was a farmhouse where people smoked pharmaceutical opium and said things like, "McInnes isn't feeling too good today. I just shot him." In Jesus's Son, even the cornfields mattered. They surrounded our town like an ocean, green and bristling in summer, high enough for mazes in September, then ravaged into dry husks for the remainder of autumn. Dreary ranks of desiccated, skeletal brown stalks. It was like Johnson was drunk dialing us from the end of time to tell us what they meant, these sweeping fields whose edges were beyond our sight. One of his characters looks at the giant screen of a drive-in cinema and mistakes it for a sacred vision. The sky was torn away and the angels were descending out of a brilliant blue summer, their huge faces streaked with light and full of pity. Johnson had mistaken the ordinary Iowa around us for something sacred, and drugs and booze had helped him do it. When Johnson arrived in Iowa City as a college freshman in the fall of 1967, he wrote his parents to say he'd accidentally purchased baby blankets he'd mistaken for towels at the Goodwill. But he was glad to find a collection of personality-ridden ties. He complained about a guy who played the banjo loudly outside his dorm room door. By November, he'd done his first stint at the county jail. While he was locked up, his friends sent him a drugstore greeting card covered with cartoon people whose droopy faces were distraught. "Please come back. We all miss you very much. And besides," the interior added, "the coast is clear." His friend Peg wrote, "Boy, I tried all day to get you out of jail, but they wouldn't do it. Your court costs are paid, so you can leave Thursday night." Peg was getting by okay. Right now, I'm at a truck stop on I-80 having a Coke. But she wanted him to know, "We're all anxiously awaiting your triumphant return." By the time Johnson was 19, he'd published his first book of poetry. And by the time he was 21, he'd been put in a psych ward for alcohol-related psychosis. I'd heard that Jesus' Son was just a bunch of memories he'd stuffed into a drawer and then sold to a publisher, years later, to pay off the IRS. I like to read one of his closing paragraphs aloud in my Iowa bedroom. "I kissed her fully, my mouth on her open mouth, and we met inside. It was there. It was. The long walk down the hall, the door opening, the beautiful stranger, the torn moon mended, our fingers touching away the tears. It was there." He was insisting that a single stupid kiss could matter, that one swooning drunk moment could matter, that even the most ordinary things could matter. The walk down the hall, the open door, even the stranger without a name. They all added up to something. What that something was, who knew? But we could sense its ragged edges. There was something beautiful and necessary about the role of pain in Johnson's stories. Truth lurked past the edges of destruction and sorrow. Something got made, like a jewel or a hatched bird, when people hurt. When a woman was told that her husband had died behind a hospital door that let out a single bar of bright light, as if diamonds were being incinerated in there, she shrieked as the narrator imagined an eagle would shriek. And he wasn't horrified, but entranced. "It felt wonderful to be alive to hear it," he said. "I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere." My undergraduate students thought it was cruel, the narrator's hunt for pain, but I thought, I get it. I would have clawed under the hospital door looking for those diamonds too, for the great heat and shriek of their destruction. At the end of that story, the narrator addressed us directly from the page. "And you, you ridiculous people, you expect me to help you." But I wasn't seeking his help so much as his glorious vision of what it meant to be broken. His characters played the part of prophet drunks, our Virgils to their hell. "Because we all believed we were tragic, and we drank," his narrator tells us, "we had that helpless, destined feeling." His stories insisted that everything around us mattered, the dream and clove smoke and sharp cold of this place. "It was there," he wrote. It was. I wanted to think of my early months with Daniel in terms of their magic, but in truth, they were also saturated with anxiety. For me, so many of our carefree adventures, the sudden trip to New Orleans, the graveyard sex, were strieded by doubt, hardly free at all. They were more like attempts to prove, to him and to myself, that whatever was happening between us was happening on a grand scale. Our stumbling, drunken run through the French Quarter played in my mind like an art house film. Wrought iron balconies, pastel shotgun apartments. I didn't just need Daniel to want me. I needed him to want everything with me. Anything less seemed like rejection. For him, I imagine this was somewhat exhausting. I had no stomach for that murky state that came between being strangers and being passionately committed for the rest of our lives. In other words, dating. I needed it all, right away, more, again, forever. I can remember Daniel telling me once, "I like you, but I'm not sure I'd want to marry you," though I've conveniently repressed whatever I said to make him say that, probably something like, "Don't you want to marry me?" If he didn't, after a month, I was ready to read it as my own failure. Drinking with Daniel wasn't just about delivering myself into the wild hands of his recklessness. It was about surviving his uncertainty. I read this uncertainty as a metaphysical conundrum, a referendum on the possibilities of intimacy, when in fact it was just honesty. It was the honesty of a 26-year-old poet living above a falafel shop. As we were stumbling home from a barbecue one night, silly in the darkness, he stopped me in the middle of the sidewalk. When he told me, "Back there, I was in love with every fucking word coming out of your mouth," it came as the confirmation of a hunch. I'd always suspected love came as a reward for saying the right things. Daniel had an ex-girlfriend who'd had cervical cancer. He'd given her HPV and felt responsible for her illness. Even though she was healthy again and they weren't together anymore, he was still preoccupied by the specter of their relationship and by his culpability in her sickness. I didn't worry about her coming out of remission and didn't even worry about getting HPV myself. I only worried I would never mean as much to him as she had. One weekend, we all went camping out at Lake McBride, me and Daniel and his crew of older poet friends. It was early spring. The air smelled like wet dirt. Everything was raw from just melted snow. I was scared of saying the wrong thing, but also scared of saying nothing at all. How much more could I say about the truck stop? What else did I have? I sucked down beer after beer and hardly touched my hamburger. I remember being nervous, and then I remember nothing. I woke up in a tent the next morning, and Daniel told me they'd gotten worried. The night before, I'd wandered off into the woods and hadn't come back. He thought I was peeing, but then I still hadn't come back. He went looking and eventually found me hunched at the base of a tree. What was I doing there? He wondered. We wondered together. I was starting to learn the social etiquette of the post-blackout processing session. Letting someone tell me what I'd done and then helping him figure out why I might have done it. "I did what?" I'd ask. "Why would I do that?" I pictured myself stumbling through the trees, a weird survival impulse at work. My body fleeing my own tyrannical desire to impress. My drunk self was like an embarrassing cousin I was responsible for. A houseguest in the woods who was undeniably my fault, though I couldn't remember inviting her. In 1967, Life magazine published an 8-page profile of John Berryman titled "Whiskey and Ink." Whiskey and Ink. It featured photos of the bearded genius poet befriending entire Dublin pubs, holding forth over a flock of foam-lipped empty pints, carrying the burden of his wisdom and the antidote of his whiskey. "Whiskey and ink," it began. "These are the fluids John Berryman needs. He needs them to survive and describe the thing that sets him apart from other men and even from other poets. His uncommonly, almost maddeningly penetrating awareness of the fact of human mortality." It wasn't quite the white logic, but it was close. Whiskey didn't grant Berryman his vision, but it helped him endure it. The profile still sketched that shimmering link between drinking and darkness, between drinking and knowing. It also included a full-page Heineken ad. Berryman's most famous poems, the Dream Songs, conjure a landscape full of booze and tortured knowledge. "I am outside," his speaker announces. "Incredible panic rules. Drinks are boiling. iced drinks are boiling. Even the iced drinks are boiling. It has come to that. Berryman's persona, Henry, often speaks with a drunk voice sweating heavy on the page, asking himself some questions. Are you radioactive, pal? Pal, radioactive. Has you got the night sweats and the day sweats, pal? Pal, I do. The dream songs breathe a weird new form of oxygen. Hey out there, assistant professors, full associates, instructors, others, any, Henry announces. I have a thing to say. I have a thing to say. His drunk voice performs its intoxication to the point of absurdity, suggesting that creation has to happen beyond the borderlines of comfort. One of Berryman's friends once told him that he lived like he'd spent his whole fucking life out in the weather without any protection, eyes ragged from what they have seen and try to look away from. Berryman arrived for his own stint in Iowa City at the age of 40, with plenty of baggage back in New York. A recent separation from his first wife, a girlfriend getting an abortion, an overdue bill to his analyst. At present, the figure is mountainous, which discourages you from starting, this analyst wrote to him. But please start. The day Berryman showed up in Iowa, he fell down a flight of stairs and broke his wrist. He developed a reputation for praising Whitman's long lines in bar booths and drunk dialing his students in the middle of the night. Mr. Berryman often called me, Bet Schissel recalled, usually in a deeply agitated state, often incoherent and rambling, seeking reassurance that he had been outstanding or brilliant at his morning lecture. He was a fragile oracle. Of Henry, he wrote, hunger was constitutional with him. Wine, cigarettes, liquor, need, until he went to pieces. The pieces sat up and wrote. Hunger ran in the family. Berryman's mother wrote to him about craving her own mother's affection. I, who longed for her love and have love-groped my way through life for the need of it. Berryman's own need broke him into pieces, but the pieces got the writing done. I have the authority of suffering, extraordinary suffering, I think, Berryman insisted, and he identified with the drunk, tormented geniuses who had come before him. Hart Crane, Edgar Allan Poe, Dylan Thomas. He compared himself to Baudelaire, in violent temper and razor sensibility to disgrace, in his savage self-contempt which is brother to mine. The dead were always breathing down his neck. His father committed suicide when he was 11. Part of Berryman was attached to his own trauma and its residue. He even wrote to his unpaid analyst, confessing anxiety about the risk of impeding his creativity by resolving his emotional problems. He compared his case to Rilke's. I would not worry, his analyst replied, about an analogy to Rilke and a possible damage to your creative skills. These are not, in your case, so intertwined with your emotional problems that the solution of one must lead to the destruction of the other. For many years, this was Berryman's operative logic. Pain promised inspiration and booze promised relief, a way to endure the authority of suffering. Berryman's friend Saul Bellow echoed the notion that Berryman's drinking allowed him to withstand his own dark wisdom. Inspiration contained a death threat, and drink was a stabilizer. It somewhat reduced the fatal intensity. But if Berryman believed this, that drink helped him survive the fatal intensity of his own poetic vision, he couldn't deny that it left other intensities in its wake. He got fired from his teaching job at Iowa after going to jail on charges of public intoxication and disturbing the peace. When I encountered the legend of Berryman, I found an appealing air of complicatedness in his affairs, the sweet, boozy whiff of tangle and rupture. With your work, a friend wrote to him, I often have the feeling that your poems are the light we see now from a star that is already ashes. What role could sobriety possibly play in that glorious arc of blaze and rot? In the dream songs, I saw proof of a tormented consciousness and proof that you could write from torment. I saw what Berryman's pieces sat up and wrote. Something can, has been said for sobriety, but very little. In Iowa,